my back yesterday, so I was like, oh, I got to climb up there. It's good to be with you this afternoon. So the temptation of Jesus is one of the most familiar stories in the Gospels, one that is placed at the beginning of Jesus' ministry in all three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and here in Luke. The story begins with Jesus being led into the desert by the Holy Spirit. But what was that desert like? William Barclay, a New Testament scholar, provides the following description. The inhabited part of Judea stood on the central plateau, which was the backbone of southern Palestine. Between it and the Dead Sea stretched a terrible wilderness, 35 by 15 miles. It was called Jeshimon, which means the devastation. The hills were like dust heaps. The limestone looked blistered and peeling. The rocks were bare and jagged. The ground sounded hollow to the horses' hooves. It glowed with heat like a vast furnace and ran out to the precipices 1,200 feet high, which plunged down to the Dead Sea. Now, it's one thing to think of the Holy Spirit leading Jesus into the desert. It's another thing to think of him leading Jesus into the devastation. Many North American churches don't like to think about the devastation. Certainly, that is true of the evangelical tradition I grew up in. The songs we sang were characterized by victory, thanksgiving, and assurance. But there was a decided absence of sorrow, suffering, or uncertainty. As a case in point, I didn't even learn about Lent until I went to a Christian university. We were more interested in victorious Christian living, at times teetering on the edge of a prosperity theology. And alas, many churches remain in a similar space today. So it is a bit of a shock to realize that Jesus initiated his ministry with a journey into the devastation. It's even more of a shock to realize that his entire ministry was itself a journey to an even greater devastation, culminating in the cross. And perhaps for many of us, the greatest shock of all is to come to terms over our lives with the fact that his call is a call for us into our own devastation as we take up our crosses and follow him. The truth is, the Spirit does lead us into the devastation. It may be a cancer diagnosis, a lost job, the death of a loved one, or smoke damage from a fire. As the words of Ash Wednesday remind us, all of us must face the reality of our own mortality. We are dust, and to dust we shall return. So it is critical to remember when we are in the wilderness that Jesus has been through that same devastation. And even now he walks with us on our Spirit-led journey. Well, now I want to shift from the setting to the events themselves. I don't have a lot of time here, so I want to focus on one particular question. And that is, how do we describe specifically what happened to Jesus? Now, at first blush, it seems obvious to many, he was tempted. But what if that is wrong? What if Jesus was not, in fact, tempted? What if something else happened to him? And what might that mean for us? The first thing we have to appreciate, as I even pose this question, is that we're dealing with English translations. The Greek verb is perao, that's the basic verb. So in verse 2, for 40 days he was, perao is the verb, by the devil. And there are two basic translation choices that English Bible translators make. Most English translations from the King James to the NIV translate perao with the English verb tempt. For 40 days, he was tempted by the devil. But a minority of translations, including the Message, the CEV, and the NRSV, instead use the verb test, For 40 days he was tested by the devil. Now, there are some translation choices that are really just a matter of style. You say potato, I say potato. They're not a big difference. But in my view, this is not one of those. I actually believe the choice that we make here between tempt and test is significant. And getting the word right or wrong could have important implications for how we think about Jesus and ultimately about ourselves. Let's consider first the majority opinion that what happened to Jesus should be understood as temptation. First, we should be clear on what it means to tempt. Here's dictionary.com. To tempt is to entice or allure to do something often regarded as unwise, wrong, or immoral. In short, to be tempted is to experience the desire for something that is bad for you. The badness could be a non-moral badness. For example, you may be tempted by the devil's food cake. It's not immoral for you to eat it, but it is bad for your diet. And for that reason, you should not eat it. The badness could also be immoral. For example, you may be tempted to curse the fellow motorist who just cuts you off in traffic. Or for those who play Mario Kart, like my wife and I do every evening, when your spouse throws a red shell at you. In each case, the core idea behind experiencing temptation is that you feel the allure or desire for some bad object or action, whether non-moral or immoral. Conversely, if you never experienced an enticement or allure of that bad thing, then by definition, you weren't tempted by it. So why did people interpret what Jesus experienced in this story as temptation? Well, here's one reason. Hebrews 4:15, in this passage we read the following. We do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted, tested, depending on the translation, in every way just as we are, yet he did not sin. One good reason why one might render this tempt is because the author says that Jesus' experience was like ours in every way, except for one salient difference. He didn't sin. So if his experience was like ours in every other way, wouldn't that include experiencing the enticement or allure to do wrong? And if that is the case, then Jesus experienced temptation, the draw to do something wrong, and yet ultimately not doing it. Well, this is how the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament puts it. It says in Hebrews, the whole point was to emphasize that the temptation of Jesus is like ours. In other words, it carried with it the possibility that he might fall. Or, in the terms that I'm putting it to you, it carried with it the enticement or allure of that thing. Because if you don't find it enticing or alluring, there's not a chance you'll fall to it. Hence, it was a true temptation. This leads directly into another argument for temptation, the temptation view, one that is pastoral in nature. The argument goes like this: if Jesus was tempted, he experienced all the allures and enticements that we do and yet did not act upon them, he resisted them, then we can fully identify with him knowing that he has experienced all the things we do and yet remained faithful. So that's a quick summary of the tempt view. But now I'm going to explain why I think the tempt view is the incorrect one. And let me just say, at the end of the day, you're free to disagree with me. Let's just think about it together. So here I want to give three reasons why I think we should ultimately view what happened to Jesus not so much as a tempting, but rather as a testing, revealing, in fact, that he could not be tempted in the manner that we are. Now, the first reason is based on Luke 4 itself. The reasoning goes like this. Typically, if you are tempted by something, if you find it enticing or alluring, there's like a pause on it. There's like the struggle with it. If you look at that chocolate cake, you're like, that devil's food cake looks good. But no, I must resist and stay true to my diet. If, on the other hand, the very prospect of having that devil's food cake at that moment repels you, if you don't find it tempting at all, you're not going to pause or linger. Rather, you will say a definitive, ick, no thanks. So when we read about Jesus encountering the devil in the devastation, does he pause and linger and struggle or not? And when I read it, it seems like he does not. Read, for example, the devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command the stone to become a loaf of bread." Jesus answered him, "It is written, one does not live by bread alone." When I read this, I think of a particular GIF. Do you know what GIFs are on social media? They're like short video clips of things, often humorous, that people post online. And there's one GIF I've seen that depicts the Incredible Hulk, you know, the big green guy. And he punches somebody like this, and they go flying off. Anybody seen that? Am I the only person? A couple, one or two people? Okay, you got the visual anyway in your head. Boom, that's it. That's the kind of reaction I get when I read how Jesus interacts with the devil. Boom. He's not like struggling with what the devil has offered. He's not finding it alluring or enticing. He just, you're done. I'm not the most sophisticated of people, so that's kind of where my illustrations are at. It's like social media GIFs. Now, the same cycle repeats for each one of these, quote-unquote, temptations, is he just shuts him down like that. It just does not look to me like Jesus is finding it in any way enticing or alluring what the devil is offering to him. It is a test, but it seems to be a test to reveal precisely that Jesus is not to be tempted in the way that other human beings are. Now, let me note one quick and important side note. There is one place many people would point to in the Gospels where they think, well, isn't Jesus doing that here? And that's in the Garden of Gethsemane, right? When he's right before he's going to go to the cross. But I want to submit that the Garden of Gethsemane is not illustrating Jesus in temptation to do the wrong thing against the will of his Father. Rather, it is a process of him discerning the will of his Father. Imagine that the doctor tells you, you have a tumor in your arm and we're going to have to amputate your arm. Well, what you want to do at that moment probably is go through a process of discernment. Doc, is that really the only option? Are there other modes of treatment? And you want to process all that before you ultimately decide what you're going to do. And when Jesus is facing the cross, it looks to me in Gethsemane like he is discerning the Father's will, not like he's struggling with the desire to go contrary to the will of his Father. And so he says, not my will, but thine be done. So that's the first reason why I think we ought to view what Jesus experienced not with the allure and enticement to sin that we experience in temptation, but rather in separating him from the temptations that we experience. I want to now give two more reasons, and they're both theological in nature. The second one is that we have to keep in mind that Jesus is God, the Son. And one essential feature of being divine, of being God, is moral perfection. A morally perfect being cannot be tempted by sin. They don't see the enticement or allure or draw to do the wrong thing. James says as much, I think, in James 1:13 when he says, God cannot be tempted by evil. God can be tested. We can try to put God to the test. But God cannot be enticed or allured to do the wrong thing. Since Jesus was fully God, it seems to me that Jesus, in virtue of being divine, cannot be tempted. To say that a perfect God can be tempted to do evil would conceptually be like saying a circle can have a corner. And this leads me to my third and final point. I think Jesus cannot be tempted in the manner that we experience the allure and enticement of sin because he was also perfect man. Now, this may surprise some people who think the ability to be tempted is somehow core to what it is to be human. But I disagree. And I think the error arises because when many people think about what it is to be human, they begin with Adam in the garden, thinking that our essence as humanity lies there. And if Adam could be tempted, which it clearly could be, then it's core to be human that we can be as well. I think that's a mistake. According to Genesis 1, 26 and 27, to be human is to be made in the image of God. Colossians 1, 15 tells us that Jesus is the image of God. As he said to Philip in John 14, 9, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you want to know what God is like, look to me. That means that when we become more like Jesus, through the process of sanctification, when we are conformed to him, as we read in Romans 8:29, that is not only making us more divine, it's also making us more human. It's conforming us to Jesus. I think at this point of one of Elton John's first songs, the 1969 ballad Skyline Pigeon. It tells the story of a pigeon kept in a cage and longing to be free. For this dark and lonely room projects a shadow cast in gloom, and my eyes are mirrors of the world outside. For just a skyline pigeon dreaming of the open, waiting for the day that he can spread his wings and fly away again. The song is a powerful metaphor for a longing to be freed from bondage, a release to fulfill one's true end and purpose for which they were created. In our case, the bondage is the fallen nature that imprisons us. It is not only the sins we commit, but also the distorted nature that even has enticement or allure to commit those very sins. As we are freed and liberated not only from the sins, but from the very impulses in us that find them attractive, we are released from this cage and allowed to fly free of temptation, fully conformed to the image of God. That's what it is, ultimately, to be human. Our purpose, our end, is to become the kind of people who cannot find sin enticing or alluring in the manner that we currently do. Our purpose, our end, is to become those people, and so to be free. For the person fully conformed to Jesus, sin will repel and disgust. It will not tempt. It will not entice. It will not allure. When we are fully like him, we will shut down every test offered by the devil in the same manner that Jesus does, with a Hulk punch. We should not think of Jesus as having been tempted, not only because he didn't struggle with the devil depicted in Luke 4, and not only because he's divine, but also because he is perfectly human. Now, finally, to conclude, I would like to say a word about the pastoral appeal of the temptation view. Remember that advocates of that view say that we can take comfort and inspiration in the faithfulness of Jesus because he was enticed or allured by the same sins that do entice and allure us, and yet he remained faithful. But, they say, if he was repelled by those sins, how can he be the inspiration and guide for us? Does that not undercut the full force of Hebrews 4:15? I understand why people think that way, but again, I'm not compelled. Let me give you an illustration. Imagine that you are training as an Olympic athlete, and your trainer is a world-renowned Olympic athlete who has 5 medals to their name. The two of you go for your first day of training, and after the day of training, you go and eat together, and then you find yourself lingering over the dessert menu and looking at the devil's food cake. In that moment, would you prefer your mentor linger with you over the menu with eyes of gastronomic longing before they finally resolve to forego that dessert? Would that inspire you? Or would you prefer your mentor to remain completely unmoved, look you square in the eye, and say, "Do you want a gold medal or not?" If you do, you need to be singularly focused on that goal and reject everything that may detract from it, and that includes that slice of cake. I would prefer the latter. I want a mentor in my athletic training who models what it means to be an Olympic athlete in the purest sense, one that is so singularly focused on the goal that the temptations of this life recede into nothing. That which is true of the training of an athlete is no less true in the training of a saint. Jesus is our mentor in the journey of faith. He passed through the devastation and in the process showed us not only that he was faithful, but that he could not be otherwise. So singularly focused was he upon the will of his Father. He shows us what it is to be truly human. As we journey into Lent, we are being brought into a season of liturgical deprivation, a sort of mini devastation of the soul. As we do, may we be focused on what it is to be conformed to the true will and image of him, so that we can look forward to the day when we too shall shut down every test of evil and sin and find no temptation in them, for we too shall be free. Amen.